Hi, and welcome to In the News. I'm Chris. This is Rick Anderson, and today I'll be reading selected stories from the science section of the New York Times edition of April 3rd, 2024. Our first story, to cover some of the things we did last week with telling you so much about the eclipse, says, they can't see the eclipse, but this device will help them hear it. A device called Light Sound is being distributed to help the blind and visually impaired experience this year's event. The story is by Robin Ross. On August 21, 2017, Kiki Smith's teenage sons giddily prepared to watch the partial solar eclipse in Rochester, New York. As Miss Smith listened to their chatter, she felt excluded. I felt very alone, she said. Miss Smith was diagnosed with a degenerative condition as a child and lost the last of her vision in 2011. The local buzz around the eclipse and the national media attention unexpectedly touched a nerve. The eclipse was about experiencing a historic moment in the community, and I wasn't part of that, she said. Ms. Smith, 52, who works for a community development organization in Rochester, determined to do things differently for the April 8th total eclipse that is passing through her city. She is helping to organize a public gathering that prioritizes accessibility for people with vision loss. Her event will include specially designed devices named Light Sound that translate changing light intensity into musical tones, allowing blind and visually impaired people to listen as the sky grows dark and then brightens again. During this eclipse, Ms. Smith said, I will be with community, and I will have at my fingertips all of these fabulous resources to experience what I felt I missed the first time. People across the United States with limited vision or blindness will experience the eclipse with the aid of about 900 light sound devices distributed by a team led by Allison Bierley, a Harvard University astronomer. The instrument was developed in 2017 by Ms. Bierley, the manager of Harvard's undergraduate astronomy lab and telescopes, and Wanda Diaz-Merced, an astronomer who was blind, and at the same time was with the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. After learning about the needs of visually impaired astronomers, Ms. Bierley outfitted the lab she manages with a printer that creates three-dimensional tactile representations on heat-sensitive paper of images captured by telescopes. Dr. Diaz-Merced had for more than a decade been conducting research using sonification, in which mathematical data is translated into sound. The two decided to create a device to sonify that summer's eclipse. Daniel Davis, the director of Harvard's Science Demonstration Lab, produced the prototype. On August 21st, as the total eclipse passed over her viewing spot in Wyoming, Ms. Bierley streamed the sound from the device via the internet. Dr. Diaz-Merced was then in Cape Town as a research fellow with the Office of Astronomy for Development. During the eclipse, she shared the stream with students at the Athlone School for the Blind. When they heard it, they jumped and they clapped, she said. It was the first time they were able to listen to such an event, so it was very meaningful. Roughly the size of a paperback novel, Light Sound contains a light sensor that measures the sky's brightness in lux, or units of illumination. Inside the case, code on a microcontroller board assigns particular sounds to numerical ranges of lux. A synthesizer board then generates a flute sound for intense light, a clarinet sound that lowers in pitch as the light fades, and a slow percussive clicking through the darkness of totality. Listeners use headphones or a speaker to hear the device's sonification. Ahead of the total solar eclipse that crossed Chile and Argentina in July 2, 2019, Ms. Bierley's team, funded by the International Astronomical Union, sent devices or their components to colleagues in both countries. At an event at the San Diego Planetarium, organizers connected a light sound device to an amplification system, so the more than 1,500 attendees among them, people who were blind could hear it. It's not only dedicated for the visually impaired, said Paulina Troncoso, director of the undergraduate astronomy program at the Universidad Central Region de Coquimbo, who led the light sound portion for that event, also for everyone. The team offers light sound for free and has posted the computer code and instructions for building the devices online. Ms. Baerla Group continues to tinker with the product to improve users' experience. For example, in 2017, the prototype emitted a rather shrill tone. In 2018, Soleil Hyman, then a Harvard undergraduate, redesigned the device to incorporate the synthesizer board and developed the code for its flute, clarinet, and clicking sounds. One of Dr. Troncoso's students experimented with reprogramming the board to use a simplified instrumental version of the 1997 Daft Punk song Around the World. In lowering light, the synthesized instruments switch off one by one, leaving only the sound of a drum machine. Last year, Ms. Baerla invited Elliot Richards, an engineer at Harvard, to redesign the device with a printed circuit board instead of a tangle of wires. The change makes building the devices much easier, and Ms. Baerla and Ms. Hyman, who is now a graduate student at the University of Arizona, I've taught volunteers to solder and assemble the materials at several workshops. Once people understand how light sound makes the eclipse accessible, they are eager to help, Ms. Baerla said. It's been heartwarming to me. Just the amount of work that people have given to this project and excitement around it, she said. On a balmy Saturday in March, a dozen volunteers sat lunched over tables in a classroom at the Austin Nature and Science Center in Texas, using soldering irons to attach components to the circuit boards. The acrid smell of hot metal wafted out the open door as the trill of a mockingbird in a nearby tree floated in. As volunteers tested their complicated devices, the overlapping notes of flute and clarinet resembled the din of an orchestra tuning up for a performance. Mark Sullivan, who works as a welder, learned about the workshop through the local astronomy club and decided to help. Mr. Sullivan had witnessed the August 2017 total solar eclipse in Nashville. People like him, who can see, just take it for granted, being able to look at the sun for the eclipse, he added, saying, you want to make sure everybody has the opportunity. And we'll truncate that story and go on to the next one, which says, a rock fell from space into Sweden. Who owns it on Earth? Sweden's courts have been debating claims to a meteorite that fell north of Stockholm, including whether the right to move around in nature, including on private property, extends to claiming a meteorite. The story is by Christina Anderson, who is reporting from Stockholm. The iron rock's journey from the depths of space ended with a thud in a dense pine forest about an hour north of Stockholm, around 10 on a November night 4 years ago. Unusually, its trajectory was caught on several cameras in the region used to track meteorites. That led to a weeks-long hunt and an even longer court battle over an unusual question. Who owns an unearthly object that falls to Earth? The legal case took another turn recently when an appeals court ruled in favor of the landowner, overturning a decision that had sided with the two men who had discovered the meteorite. Days after the rock landed, Anders Zetterqvist, a geologist, found the site where it first hit the ground. After several weeks of searching, his friend Andreas Forsberg, a fellow geologist, found the 30-pound chunk sticking out of the moss where it had ricocheted, about 230 feet away. It was the find of a lifetime for me, he said. It was so spectacular. And to know that it was just a couple of weeks old. Most meteorites that make it to the Earth's atmosphere burn up on entry, leaving only a trace of light, called a meteor, in the sky. The meteorite north of Stockholm, made of iron, was the 10th fresh-fall meteorite, newly landed, rather than older and buried in the ground, to have been found in Sweden. and one of only a handful of freshfall iron meteorites found in the world, Mr. Fortesberg said. After a few weeks, the men took the rock to the Swedish Museum of Natural History, where it has been since 2020. We were afraid that hundreds of people from all over would show up to search for more, Mr. Forsberg added. Better and bigger pieces could leave the country before we knew it. Dan Holstan, senior researcher in the museum's Department of Geosciences, said, "It's a textbook example of an iron meteorite. Falls of iron meteorites are rare globally. This is the only observed fall of an iron meteorite in Sweden," Dr. Holstam said. "In almost 40 years of geoscience, this was the first time I laid my hands on a newly fallen meteorite. In addition to their scientific value, meteorites are prized by collectors. In the global market of private collectors, one like this could garner tens of thousands of dollars," Dr. Holstam said. About a week after the geologists went public with their find, the owner of the estate where the meteorite had been found, Johan Bensalstierna von Engeström, sent a letter to the museum claiming ownership. The legal battle ensued. The laws regulating the ownership of found meteorites vary from country to country. In Sweden, there are none. In France and Morocco, on the other hand, the first to put his hands or her hands on it has ownership of it, Dr. Holstam said. In Denmark, they are state property. In December 2022, the Uppsala District Court ruled in favor of the geologist, deeming the meteorite movable property. A newly fallen meteorite is not part of the property on which it has landed, the judge wrote in a statement. The landowner appealed recently. The appeals court in Stockholm ruled in his favor. Judge Robert Green, one of four judges on the case, said that the appeals court ruling turned on two questions: whether the meteorites could be considered movable property, and the extent of a Swedish customary law known as Allemansrätten that provides the right of public access. Laws applying to immovable property, houses and land, are clear, the judge said. The point of departure regarding immovable property is that the landowner has the right to it, he said in an interview. But we have no specific law regarding meteorites, which made this case special. Allemansrätten entitles everyone in Sweden to move around in nature, including to hike, bike, or camp, even on private property. That includes some right to take berries and even small rocks from other people's property, Judge Green said. The plaintiffs argue that the right to pick up small things could include amber and more valuable items, but Judge Green said in his ruling, "We have made the assessment that the closest thing to hand is to consider meteorites or space rocks as part of immovable property, just like other stones, even though it may intuitively feel like a meteorite is something foreign to Earth." One judge dissented, arguing that while the meteorite should be regarded as immovable property, in this case the customary law also applied and should be interpreted to include the right to take a meteorite from private property. Allemansrätt has far-reaching implications for everyone, so it was interesting and important for us to try this, Judge Green said. Mr. Bensalstierna von Engeström praised the ruling, saying in an interview, "I want to retain ownership of it, but give it to a Swedish museum on permanent loan." He did not specify which museum, but said he wanted to benefit the public. The geologists have not decided whether to appeal Sweden's Supreme Court. Mr. Forsberg said they were disappointed by the appellate decision. "It's very sad for me and my friend," he said. "I've been passionate about collecting rocks and fossils my whole life." He added, "It's sad for all the enthusiasts that are interested in finding new meteorites. If people don't think they'll get a reward, how are we going to get people out searching?" And we move on to our next story, which asks, why do women have more autoimmune diseases? Study points to X chromosome. The molecules that silence a woman's second X chromosome can confuse the immune system, a new study suggests. The story is by Carl Zimmer. Women are much more likely than men to have their immune system turn against them. resulting in an array of so-called autoimmune diseases like lupus and multiple sclerosis. A study published recently offers an explanation rooted in the X chromosome. The research, published in the journal Cell, suggests that a special set of molecules that act on the extra X chromosome carried by women can sometimes confuse the immune system. Independent experts said that the molecules are unlikely to be the sole reason autoimmune disease skews female, but if the results hold up in further experiments, it might be possible to base new treatments on these molecules rather than on the current drugs that blunt the entire immune system. Maybe that's a better strategy, said Dr. Howard Chang, a geneticist and dermatologist at Stanford who led the new study. Male and female embryos carry 22 identical pairs of chromosomes. The 23rd pair is different. Females carry two X's, while males carry an X and a Y, which lead to the development of male sex organs. Each chromosome holds genes that, when switched on, produce proteins to do work inside of cells. You might expect that women with two copies of X would make twice as many as X proteins as men do. Instead, they produce about the same level. That's because one of the two X chromosomes is silenced. A molecule called Xist, Xist, clings to the second X chromosome like Velcro, Dr. Chang said. As hundreds of Xist molecules wrap themselves around the X chromosome, they completely shut it down. Keeping one X silent is crucial to women's health. If a gene on the second X chromosome escapes Xist's control, it will result in an excess supply of proteins, some of which could be toxic. In 2015, it occurred to Dr. Chang that silencing itself might also have a downside. His epiphany occurred while he was preparing to take his medical board exams to renew his license as a dermatologist. As part of his studies, Dr. Chang had to brush up on autoimmune diseases, memorizing the names of human proteins that can be targeted by a misdirected immune system. When he looked at the list, he was surprised to see some familiar names. When Dr. Chang isn't working as a dermatologist, he researches the X chromosome in his lab. He noticed that many of the proteins involved in autoimmune disease also helped Xist silence the X chromosome. Maybe, Dr. Chang thought, there was no coincidence. The new study emerged from years of research testing his hunch that Xist molecules could cause autoimmune disease. He and his colleagues studied a strain of mice in which the females are at high risk of the autoimmune disease lupus, while the males never develop severe cases. The researchers genetically engineered the male mice so that they, like the females, produced Xist. Once the male mice express Xist, they get much worse levels of immune disease, Dr. Chang said. The researchers also found that people with lupus or two other autoimmune disorders had high levels of antibodies to Xist-related proteins in their blood. Dr. Chang suspects that autoimmune diseases may come about during the normal process of cells dying in a woman's body. The cells spill open, dumping their molecules into the bloodstream. In women, that debris includes a lot of Xist molecules, and the proteins are attached to them. When an immune cell encounters an Xist molecule, it also finds a huge number of proteins stuck to it. This unusual experience may confuse immune cells, which then mistakenly start making antibodies to the Xist proteins. Once the immune system starts treating Xist proteins as the enemy, it may start attacking other parts of the body as well. That's because every cell sticks fragments of its proteins on its surface where immune cells can inspect them. If an immune cell encounters an Xist protein fragment, Dr. Chang proposed, it will kill the cell that presents it. Montserrat Orguera, a geneticist at the University of Pennsylvania who was not involved in the study, said the scenario was plausible. She also noted that some people make antibodies to these same proteins, including men, without developing autoimmune diseases. Dr. Melissa Lechner, an endocrinologist at UCLA who was also not involved in the work, said the new study was intriguing and it was possible that excess proteins only boost autoimmunity rather than acting as a casual trigger. The data doesn't let me distinguish between the two, she said. Some studies suggest that the X chromosome fuels autoimmune diseases in other ways. For instance, it carries a number of genes for proteins that act as signals between immune cells. If one of these genes escapes silencing, it may create extra signals that confuse the immune system. The challenge the scientists face now is in figuring out how all these factors work collectively produce the female bias in immune disease. This is biology. It's a beautiful thing, but it's frustrating, Dr. Anguera said. And we move now to our final story, which asks, why are older Americans drinking so much? The pandemic played a role in increased consumption, but alcohol use among people 65 and older was climbing even before 2020. The story is by Paula Spann. The phone awakened Doug Nordman at 3 a.m. A surgeon was calling from a hospital in Grand Junction, Colorado, where Mr. Nordman's father had arrived at the emergency room, incoherent and in pain, and then lost consciousness. At first, the staff thought he was suffering a heart attack, but a CT scan found that part of his small intestine had been perforated. A surgical team repaired the hole, saving his life, but the surgeon had some questions. Was your father an alcoholic? He asked. The doctors had found Dean Nordman malnourished, his peritoneal cavity awash with alcohol. The younger Mr. Nordman, a military personal finance author living in Oahu, Hawaii, explained that his 77-year-old dad had long been a classic social drinker, a scotch and water with his wife before dinner, which got topped off during dinner, and then another after dinner, and perhaps a nightcap. Having 3 to 4 drinks daily exceeds current dietary guidelines, which define moderate consumption as 2 drinks a day for men and 1 for women or less. But that was the normal drinking culture of the time, said Doug Nordman, now 63. At the time of his 2011 hospitalization, though, Dean Nordman, a retired electrical engineer, was widowed, living alone, and developing symptoms of dementia. He got lost while driving, struggled with household chores, and complained of slipping memory. He had waved off his 2 sons' offers of help, saying he was fine. During that hospitalization, however, Doug Nordman found hardly any food in his father's apartment. Worse, reviewing his father's credit card statements, I saw recurring charges from the liquor barn and realized he was drinking a pint of scotch a day, he said. Public health officials are increasingly alarmed by older Americans drinking. The annual number of alcohol-related deaths from 2020 through 2021 exceeded 178,000, according to recently released data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more deaths than from all drug overdoses combined. An analysis by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism shows that people over 65 accounted for 38% of that total. From 1999 to 2020, the 237% increase in alcohol-related deaths among those over 55 was higher than for any age group except 25 to 34-year-olds. Americans largely fail to recognize the hazards of alcohol, said George Koob, the director of the institute. Alcohol is a social lubricant when used within the guidelines, but I don't think they realize as the dose increases, it becomes a toxin, he said. And the older population is even less likely to recognize that. The growing number of older people accounts for much of the increase in deaths, Dr. Koob said. An aging population foreshadows a continuing surge that has Healthcare providers and elder advocates worried, even if older people's drinking behavior doesn't change. But it has been changing. Proportions of people over 65 who report using alcohol in the past year, about 56%, and the past recent month, about 43%, are lower than for all other groups of adults. But older drinkers are markedly more likely to do it frequently on 20 or more days a month than younger ones. Moreover, a 2018 meta-analysis found that binge drinking, defined as four or more drinks on a single occasion for women, five or more for men, had climbed nearly 40% among older Americans over the past 10 to 15 years. So what's going on here? The pandemic has clearly played a role. The CDC reported deaths attributed directly to alcohol use, emergency room visits associated with alcohol, and alcohol sales per capita all rose from 2019 to 2020 as COVID arrived and restrictions took hold. Now, a lot of stressors impacted us. The isolation, the worries about getting sick, Dr. Koob said. They pointed to people drinking more to cope with that stress. Researchers also cite a cohort effect. Compared to those before and after them, the boomers are a substance-using generation, said Keith Humphreys, a psychologist and addiction researcher at Stanford, and they are not abandoning their youthful behavior, he said. Studies show a narrowing gender divide, too. Women have been drivers of change in this age group, Dr. Humphreys said. From 1997 to 2014, drinking rose an average of 0.7% a year for men over 60, while their binge drinking remained stable. Among older women, drinking climbed by 1.6% annually, with binge drinking up 3.7%. Contrary to stereotypes, upper middle class educated people have higher rates of drinking, Dr. Humphreys explained. In recent decades, as women grew more educated, they entered the workplaces where drinking was normative. They also had more disposable income. Women retiring now are more likely to drink than their mothers and grandmothers, he said. Yet alcohol packs a greater wallop for older people, especially for women, who become intoxicated more quickly than men because they're smaller and they have fewer of the gut enzymes that metabolize alcohol. Seniors may argue they are merely drinking the way they always have, but equivalent amounts of alcohol have much more disastrous consequences for older adults whose bodies cannot process it as quickly, said Dr. David Osselin, a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania and the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Philadelphia. It causes slower thinking, slower reaction time, and less cognitive capacity when you're older, he said, ticking off the risks. Long associated with liver diseases, alcohol also exacerbates cardiovascular disease, renal disease, and if you've been drinking for many years, there's an increase in certain kinds of cancers. Drinking contributes to falls, a major cause of injury as people age, and disrupts sleep. Older adults also take a lot of prescription drugs, and alcohol interacts with a long list of them. These interactions can be particularly common with pain medications and sleep aids like benzodiazepines, sometimes causing over-sedation. In other cases, alcohol can reduce a drug's effectiveness. Dr. Osselin cautions that many prescription bottles carry labels that warn against using those drugs with alcohol. Patients may shrug that off, explaining that they take their pills in the morning and don't drink until evening. These medications stay in your system all day long, so when you drink, there's still that interaction, he tells them. And sadly, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Rick Anderson. I've been reading selected stories from the April 3rd, 2024 edition of the New York Times. Thank you so much for listening, and hey, let's do this again next week.